Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the government's big commission on the financial crisis hears testimony on what went wrong. Washington is wrestling with its answer, with financial regulation. Roger Lowenstein, one of the country's top financial writers and author of a new book on Wall Street's collapse, understands, like few others, what happened, why it happened, and what it will take to steer away from a repeat. This hour, On Point, Roger Lowenstein on the Wall Street meltdown and the future of American finance. Joining me now from New York is Roger Lowenstein. He's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine and former reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He's also an outside director at the mutual fund Sequoia Fund. His books include Origin of the Crash, The Great Bubble and Its Undoing, and When Genius Failed, The Rise and Fall of Long-Term Capital Management. His new book just out is The End of Wall Street. Roger Lowenstein, thanks very much for being here.
Tom, it's a pleasure to be on the show.
You make the kind of sweeping observations after a whole lot of amazing insight and detail I think the country's hungry for. I mean, you write very early in the book, you say the U.S. spent nearly a decade losing ground because of this and around this, a decade that, according to the country's highest sages, was to have ushered in an era of nearly uniformly advancing prosperity. The subprime binge, you write, that Bernanke had supposed was a contained problem turned out to be a symptom of a full credit mania. Ultimately, it destroyed the American workplace. Such was the bitter fruit of Wall Street's folly. That's about as sweeping an economic indictment as I can imagine, Roger.
Tom, we have fewer jobs now than we had 10 years ago in this country, even though we have 30 million more people living in the country. By the way, we lost 8 million jobs. And by the way, only about 50,000 or so of those jobs were on Wall Street. The rest were, bakers, butchers, and candlestick makers, ordinary Americans who suffered basically because of Wall Street's mayhem. And I was astonished to hear Greenspan yesterday in testimony basically defend the Fed's policy. You alluded to this, idea that they couldn't have known and so on, but so many did know. Where were the regulators?
Where were the regulators, indeed? And now we come along after the fact, and there's story after story after story that one would think if we had had them in our headlights, if they'd been in the light of day earlier, surely people would have said, wait, we've got to stop. On the other hand, I'm not sure, because you remind us how strong the, markets are perfect idea was at that time, and people believed it.
Well, both of your points are well taken. The story is the reason I go back in the book is I want to remind people of how far off the tracks we got, that for years, people were walking into banks, getting mortgages without supplying any documentation. In many cases, the banks were willfully encouraging borrowers to commit fraud, to lie. They didn't care whether people could pay back their loans or not, because the old days, we remember when the banker looked you in the eye and asked you about your home life and your job, and then if he gave you a loan, kept it for 30 years, that was long gone. These days, these bankers were giving you money and then flipping it to Wall Street, who in turn would flip it to investors. And so they really didn't care whether your credit was any good. It was just a game of in the door and out the door. Your point about have we learned anything, the biggest error that Wall Street made and that the regulators permitted them to make was by being too much leverage. What does too much leverage mean? It means they were using borrowed money. I mean, it's something that we all learn from our parents. Don't overborrow,
And they did this, like crazy.
We could have had this discussion in 1998 when that hedge fund blew up. Mm-hmm. We could have had this discussion when Michael Milken's junk bond firms blew up. And it's a lesson that Wall Street doesn't seem to want to learn.
I want to look at that in a number of other points where we can take them forward to the regulations under consideration now and ask you what's adequate and what's not. But the way you described just there, if we can pause for a moment on that, these
sure.
mortgages going in the door and lending in the door, out the door, nobody really paying attention, nobody really caring. This at the same time that we got the message, the orthodoxy was that the markets are wise. But if the bankers knew that this stuff was often schlock and they didn't care, Does that mean they believe markets are wise, or they were just winking at that and said, you know, well, we don't know if they're wise or not. We're just playing our own game here. It sounds like fundamental corruption.
It was a little of each. There's one story in the book where somebody goes into Countrywide Savings, applies for a loan with full documentation, and he's rejected. And by the way, in 2004, it was pretty tough to get rejected for a mortgage.
Yes, yes.
The banker then, instead of showing him the door, says, why don't you reapply but without documents? Don't show me any paperwork. You just tell me what you earned and what your assets are. And this time he's accepted. You know, it's the same candidate, only without documents. So obviously in that case, the banker was corrupt. I think there were many other cases where the bankers were just drinking the Kool-Aid and believing it was okay, or not really caring because they were selling the loans off, as I mentioned, so quickly. They didn't really have any skin in the game, as we say on Wall Street. And there was one gatekeeper there. There was somebody looking out for those loans, because who did the bank sell them to? They sold them to investors. Why did investors trust those mortgage-backed securities? It wasn't because they were going house to house interviewing mortgage owners. They were looking at the credit rating on those mortgage-backed bonds. And it was the credit rating agencies that said, it's okay, we've looked at the mortgages underneath, these are AAA, you don't have to worry.
But you write, and they must have known that those rating agencies got paid a couple hundred thousand dollars every time they rated one of these, and if they didn't give it a good rating, somebody else would simply get the business. So even the lenders must have known that was punky as can be.
Yeah, you know, the lenders knew, but they were flipping it off. It was the ultimate investor that was the one in many cases holding the bag, although obviously many of these mortgage securities stayed on the books of Wall Street banks because that's what took them down. When Stan O'Neill, the chairman of Merrill Lynch, learned in the summer of 07, which, by the way, was more than a year before the ultimate crash, that Merrill was holding $50 billion of mortgage-backed CDOs on its books, he effectively saw his tombstone in the
paper. His jaw dropped, as you described.
He knew the firm was dead. He immediately began to try and sell it. It didn't happen until they were an extremist a year later. The point you made also I want to touch on about this belief that markets are always right. When I asked before where were the regulators, Alan Greenspan, who testified yesterday and who was running the show for most of this period, and also Ben Bernanke, who succeeded him, are steeped in this ethos that if markets did it, it had to be right. You know, that to Greenspan in particular, who was grew up at the foot of Ayn Rand, markets were, and I say in the book, he had this Rousseauian version of markets as coming straight from nature. Markets are made by men. There's nothing perfect about markets. They mess up all the time. But Greenspan, being a true blue ideologue, wouldn't let himself see it.
But oh, the irony. And I'm sorry to keep quoting you back to yourself, but for listeners, I love how bold you are at sort of cutting through. You write, less than a generation after the fall of the Berlin Wall, when prevailing orthodoxy held that the free market could govern itself, and when financial regulation seemed destined for near irrelevancy, the United States was compelled to socialize lending and mortgage risk and even the ownership of banks on a scale that would have made Lenin smile. Put paid to all that, you say. But have we really taken that on board? And if that's not working, what is working? What's our operating, sort of theory of American finance now?
Well, obviously the theory we had doesn't work. And, right now, 9 out of every 10 mortgages that are taken out are sold to Fannie and Freddie, which are wards of the state. So people may like to think that we have a free market in this country, but the housing market is totally owned by and controlled by the U.S. government. Bond markets are still being propped up by the Federal Reserve. The question is, how do we get out of this and get back to a more normalized situation? And when we do it, are we willing to just let people own the homes that they can afford, or are we going to continue to have the federal government backstopping mortgages, as Fannie and Freddie did for all those years, and then having to pick up what has really been, an unanticipated huge tab, over $100 billion now just for those two firms.
But does anybody know what normal was anymore? Is Wall Street really willing to go back, or, really willing to let go of the ideological framework that they've operated in for the last, several decades?
I think the country is willing to let go. Has let go. I don't know if Wall Street is. That's the title of the book, The End of Wall Street. There was this idea that bankers could be fully trusted to set their own limits, There was this idea that recessions were a thing of the past. Bernanke was saying the Fed has learned to moderate recessions. You know, mm-hmm. whatever happened in the 1930s or those tough Rust Belt recessions, the 1980s, that was done with. The Federal Reserve had figured all that out. I think that sort of idea that we could trust the private market to operate itself without any regulation from government, that all these things were, these big problems were history, you know, I think that's been done away with. I use the metaphor that just as 9/11 changed our mentality psychologically in a political sense, and that none of us are going to believe that, you know, we're living in an absolutely safe world as I think we had before then. I think this has shaken our conception of Wall Street. I think people are going to make different allocations in their portfolios. Alan Greenspan said that if a derivatives contract is negotiated by two private bankers, there's no need for government regulation. I think it's going to be a long time before a Fed chief says that again.
But if you're right, and we just got a few seconds before the break, but if you're right, why is there still a question over whether there are enough votes even for the relatively kind of modest, I think, regulations that are on the table right now in Washington?
Well, Tom, you saw what happened in healthcare. You know, something, we got something called a lobby in this country, not just for healthcare, but banking. They are all over the Senate Banking Committee and also the House as this bill goes to the floor.
Big hearings this week in Washington, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission holding hearings there. Here's Phil Angelides, former California State Treasurer, yesterday putting Alan Greenspan, the former Fed chief, on the hot seat, asking him to explain why, even though the Fed had issued guidance on predatory lending, it had failed to regulate that.
Indeed, we covered as much as one anyone could conceive of.
But if you had adopted those broader rules, the FTC could have enforced them,
and others could have enforced them. No, we did adopt a whole series of rules.
But as I said, they only covered 1% of the activity. I mean, you know, my view is, and I want to move on to another issue, is you could have, you should have, and you didn't. And I do think this is one area we have to explore, how this contagion could have been constrained.
There's the backdrop of our conversation today. And here's a little more from those hearings. This today, this is Bill Thomas, vice chair of the commission, looking into this. Former Republican congressman from California, reflecting on today's testimony from former Citigroup chairman Chuck Prince and Robert Rubin, former Treasury Secretary and top figure at Citigroup.
How do you get the top if you don't have any experiential experience whatsoever? Or your argument is at that point you don't pay any attention to it? What do you get paid for if it isn't having some intuition, understanding, knowledge, or do you just do what everybody else is doing because everybody else is doing it, and if you don't do it, then you won't make money?
Roger Lowenstein is with us from New York. Roger, you must have caught some of this. Is this just, you know, tearing our hair after the fact, or do you see the whole response to the collapse pushing forward in these hearings and the rest?
Well, you know, Angelides' point was terrific when he was grilling Greenspan, and it's actually worse than Angelides may have realized. In 2005, John Dugan, who is the head of another banking regulatory agency, the Comptroller of the Currency, mm-hmm. went to the Fed and to Alan Greenspan and said, banks are writing all kinds of crazy mortgages. We got to come down on them and stop this. And the Fed just wouldn't move. They delayed for about a year and a half. And, you know, Greenspan said, well, we did put rules in. By the time they put rules in, there was no one writing mortgages anyway. The bubble was ready to burst. So, you know, Angelides was exactly right to grill Greenspan. One thing that there's been no progress on, to get to your question, is Greenspan all along has had this philosophy that, you know, you don't, as we say, prick bubbles. He just has a native mistrust of the idea that you can ever intervene in markets. And Bernanke has adopted that for his own. In fact, Bernanke says you can never really tell when there's a bubble going on, although many, many critics were saying 2003, 2004, mm-hmm. 2005, credit's too easy.
Take away the punch bowl, please.
Take away the punch bowl. That's the Fed's job. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd like to see, you know, Congress redirect the Fed, hey, this is your job. When these bubbles inflate, the consequences are serious. And there hasn't been any progress on that.
Let's do some point by point, because you've got such a great anecdote here on what happened. And if we can triangulate forward to what's now being proposed and whether or not you think it's effective. You talked about leverage, and we had huge leverage here where, you know, for every dollar some of these banks held, Lehman had another $26 in the game. Bear Stearns, another $29. Morgan Stanley, $32. I mean, a dollar of their own money and, you know, that much more of other people's being wagered into a truly, what you call a truly manic market. What happened? And is there regulation on the table that would rein that in so it doesn't bite us again?
Tom, the regulation has got to have teeth. There is regulation on the table, but I'm afraid it doesn't have teeth. What the pieces on the table say now is they're going to create a new systemic risk regulator, a council of wise men and women who are going to sit back and say, is this a period of systemic risk? Are there certain institutions that are particularly systemically risky? And if so, they're going to recommend to the Fed that capital limits or limits on leverage on debt be higher for those firms. Why don't I like that? The first thing is, it's very hard to tell in advance who's systemically risky. Nobody was paying attention to Bear Stearns before it blew up. Nobody certainly was paying attention to a little subsidiary in London of AIG, which was the one that was writing all those derivatives, which, you know, single-handedly almost took down Wall Street. Do I trust another council of wise men the next time to predict who's going to be systemically risky? No, I don't.
Is there anything to keep Morgan Stanley from getting back to a 31-to-1 leverage, or, you know?
Right now there isn't. And, you know, if you had in the bill something that said no bank can borrow more than 15 times its capital.
Mm-hmm.
And if they did, for instance, we're going to start taxing you. We're going to say we're going to consider you a greater risk, and you're going to have to pay an escalating insurance premium because we're going to consider you with all this debt to be a risk to yourselves and to others.
The House bill has a ceiling at 15-to-1, right? Why isn't that in Chris Dodsville? He knows all about this.
It does. The House bill is definitely a step ahead, but that's only for institutions that the regulator deems systemically important. That's definitely better than Dodd's bill, but I would like to see them not have to rely on this decision-making about who's systemically important. You remember when this hedge fund, long-term capital, blew up in 1998?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was paying attention. Nobody would have included them in a list of systemically important institutions.
So
we just don't know in
advance. Why isn't it here, Roger? Why these guys, looking at this, Barney Frank's paid a lot of attention to the House. Chris Dodd's been in this realm for a long time. So why isn't it in
the packet? They are fighting tooth and nail. Leverage on the downside maximizes losses. On the upside, it amplifies gains.
Sure.
The bankers don't want to see their profits go away.
Yeah, but are we keeping the country's economy at risk so they can have those super paydays for some more?
Well, we have, and this is what we have to start. We have to say, you know, on the highways, we say, we know you'd like to get there in a hurry, but for your safety and other people's safety, we're going to put on speed limits. In the financial system, speed limits are caps on leverage, and we got to do it.
But it's not happening. That's pretty well, at least not in the degree that you think it ought to.
It's not in there in the degree that it should. And it's, if you had to do one thing to prevent a recurrence, this is what you have to do. And so far, it's not there.
That's kind of mind-boggling. Let's take on another one. Everybody learned about CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, and bundling a little bit during this. Take us back. Remind us what that was, how far it went, and what's going on with that in the new proposed regulations.
CDOs, if you go back to our grandfather's era, as I mentioned earlier in the program, when you got a mortgage, it stayed in the drawer for 30
local
years.
Bank,
and then you had a party and you burned the mortgage,
mm-hmm.
right? The downside of that was the banker had to watch over you for 30 years, and he didn't get his money back for 30
mm-hmm,
years,
mm-hmm.
so he couldn't lend to anybody else. In the 1980s, Wall Street found a way to connect Main Street to Wall Street by saying, we'll bundle up those mortgages and sell them to investors. Just in one step, and then the banker on the corner got his capital back, and he could make a loan to someone else.
And off goes that bundle as a CDO, a collateralized debt obligation.
No, we're not a CDO yet. We're just a simple, plain vanilla mortgage-backed security. But it wasn't a bad idea. But there's an adage on Wall Street: you don't get in trouble with the bad ideas because they're dropped. You get in trouble with the good ideas because they're taken to extreme. They began to take these mortgage-backed bonds, splice them up, and mix them together with other mortgage-backed bonds and create a second-order derivative, a CDO. So We'll take this real slowly. If the first order mortgage-backed security was were bonds that were based on mortgages, the CDO were bonds that were based on bonds that were based mm-hmm. on mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and each level, right, the banker gets another fee.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you'd think that that would have been enough for them, but then some smart banker comes along and says, if we can do CDOs, why can't we do CDOs squared? And I don't want to give anyone a headache right now, but
yeah.
they would take the CDOs and bundle them into a next level. And it even got to the level of CDOs cubed. So when you have four levels of securities, you really just have a huge, at each level, a machine for generating fees for the bankers. And the investor at the far end who's buying these is so removed from the underlying product, which, remember, we're home mortgage,
mm-hmm.
says, they have no idea, absolutely no idea what the quality is.
You remind us that when the Merrill CEO learned that Merrill owned $48 billion worth of
That's
those.
Right.
He just blanched. And though, I don't know, it was about 2 seconds later, he was in touch with the Bank of America saying, how about merging? How about buying us?
That's right. And the Merrill board thought he was wrong and fired him. And this is Stan O'Neill. And a year later, of course, they did merge with Bank of America at a much lower price for Merrill.
Okay, so if that bundling and rebundling of assets, you know, doesn't serve a purpose, really, if it shouldn't be allowed, is that in the bills? Is that going to be regulated?
It's not the best solution is not in the bills. The best solution is something that Mary Shapiro, the SEC, came out with this morning, which is a proposal. Remember, go back to how do they sell these CDOs? They sold them to investors, and why did the investors buy them?
Mm-hmm.
They bought them because there's a credit rating on them. Believe it or not, those credit ratings are endorsed by the government. The government says to buy those CDOs, they have to have a credit rating from either Moody's, S&P and Fitch.
Mm-hmm.
Who pays Moody's, S&P and Fitch? Well, the people bundling the mortgages.
Sure.
You know, so the system had a built-in bias towards corruption.
Okay.
And what the bills really give the credit rating agencies a free ride. But what the SEC is proposing doing in a regulatory step, as distinct from a legislative step,
mm-hmm.
is just to say no more credit ratings, no more officially recognized credit ratings. The government is not going to put a stamp, a seal of good approval on these credit rating agencies. You, the issuing companies, are going to be responsible for the safety and soundness of your own bonds. Now,
it's kind of buyer beware, but that puts the fiduciary responsibility back on them. There's nothing to cover it up with, a few stars.
That's right. And the other suggestion people have made, and this is in a bill but in a pretty minor way,
mm-hmm.
is the originating banks – even when they sell off these mortgages, they should have to hold on to what's in the bill, I believe now, is 5%. So even though you fob off most of that mortgage into a mortgage-backed security and a CDO and a CDO squared, you're still hanging on to 5% of it. And if it goes down, 5% of that is going to be on you.
So do you think we're fixing this bundling cubed CDO squared problem or not?
You know, I think the best solution would be the SEC's is to take away the credit rating defense. It's very hard to stop investors when they get giddy. You can't stop Wall Street from falling in love. And periodically investors, Wall Street gets giddy about something. They believed, 10 years ago that every dot-com stock was going to the sky. They didn't need to see earnings. They bought them anyway. 5 years ago, it was about mortgage securities. I don't think we're ever going to cure Wall Street's propensity for getting dizzy, particularly because we know next time it's going to be something else. We don't know if it'll be oil stocks or daffodils or whatever, but my bet is it won't be mortgages or dot-coms.
We're talking with Roger Lowenstein. His new book is The End of Wall Street. But, you know, Roger, I can imagine many listeners, certainly I'm a little tired of this Wall Street will always be dizzy. You know, it's like, oh, kids will just be kids. It doesn't seem good enough when you go through the kind of damage that we've just taken as a country. Their job, Wall Street's fundamental job, as you point out, is to oil the economy, to make it run. It's an important job. But if you're doing it in a way that takes the economy off the rails, and you ought to know that's what you're doing, do we have to have that degree of dizziness going on? Our livelihoods are on the line here.
Well, I think one thing we could do is to start paying executives on a basis that reflects their performance and their past performance, their proven performance, not what they might do. And particularly not what they've shown they can't do. You know, you mentioned the two Citigroup executives on the dock.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck Prince and
Bob Rubin.
I think Bob Rubin as well. Rubin and Prince both made more than $100 million over their tenures for wrecking, the greatest franchise, the largest and most powerful banking franchise in the country's history. If executives were responsible, if, as Warren Buffett says, they had to eat their own cooking, mm-hmm. you would at least hope. You know, Bob Rubin is a guy who made his reputation on monitoring risk, on being the guru of uncertainty. The Dodd bill has a plank for non-mandatory say on pay, where investors would be able to at least vote and express whether they approve of the executives' mm-hmm. bonuses. Why isn't that mandatory? Your boss and my boss have the right to pay us what they want. Why shouldn't the shareholders who own the companies have a mandatory voice on whether or not these bonuses and ordinary pay as well they approve of?
Well, this seems fundamental. You title your book The End of Wall Street. That can have a lot of meanings, but I take it that one meaning is an era is ending. But I think some people are concerned, and maybe off this very point, that it's not actually ending. I mean, if it's optional, if we get right back in that same pay merry-go-round with all of its incentives.
You know, this is a point where I think we've made the least progress on, and pay right now is down because profits have been down and people are still a little red-faced. But if we don't put limits in, you know they're going to get greedy again. And I think the only way to do it is to give a mandatory voice to the owners of the business. Do they really want to pay a guy $100 million for walking away from a complete failure?
That does not seem like too much to ask. After all, they are the vaunted shareholders. They own the company. Let's get our callers. They've been waiting. Sheila in New York, De Poyster, New York. Sheila, you're on the air with Roger Lowenstein.
Hi, I'm really enjoying the show. My question is there any way possible regulation could be put in? Because it seems like what we hear now is a lot of anti-government sentiment. They bring up Freddie Mae and Freddie Mac, and then they bring up that it's all the person's own fault for taking a mortgage they shouldn't have or taking a risk. And then they kind of just slide everybody else's responsibility out of the way, or else they bundle it with, oh, they're going to do regulations that'll increase our taxes, we won't have freedom. And it seems like these groups being promoted by certain media outlets are working for slipping these regulations back and not blaming the financial sector and bundling it with all this confusing stuff instead of making it more prominent.
Yeah, Sheila, we've got it. Our time is short before the break, but I think everybody knows what you're talking about. It gets fuzzy, the way it's handled, the way it's talked about. Roger, you make it very clear. There's a kind of laser-like clarity. But without that, the danger of things not really being fixed seems substantial.
Yeah, I think what Sheila's referring to, this idea that bankers are trying to obfuscate what's going on in Washington because they think government will mess things up and things should be left to bankers. That was the ethos in the 90s and the O's. I think if we've learned anything, at least I hope we've learned it over the last few years, they say war is too important to be left to the generals, but finance is too important to be left to the bankers for sure.
Roger, here's a web comment. This is from Dave. He says, Tom, I tune into right-wing radio now and then for chuckles, he says, but for all kinds of... But anyway, the thinking there is that banks, Wall Street, or lack of regulation is not to blame. The crash was caused, this is that angle's view, essentially by the Community Reinvestment Act, Acorn, and government over-regulation that forced banks to make bad loans to the poor. Please ask your guests to comment on these ideas, and they are very widespread, and it's not as though you're not pretty tough on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, but how about it, Roger? How do you apportion blame here?
Oh, it was all Acorn. That was it. Without Acorn, none of this would have happened, you know? Where were they in 1963 in Dallas?
Yes,
this crash was too big to have had any single author. Alan Greenspan was at fault. Bankers, obviously private bankers, were at fault. The credit rating agencies, on and on. The Community Reinvestment Act had almost I didn't find any effect at all. I am tough on Fannie and Freddie. Fannie and Freddie were these government agencies, and there were two things going on with them. Because they were protected by the government in an implicit basis, they could borrow as much as they wanted to. You know, people figured at the end of the day, the Treasury would bail them out, as they did. And because they were also private companies trying to make a profit, they had an incentive to grow their balance sheet as much as they could, and therefore they borrowed way too much, and they got into trouble and they fell up. So the government backing of them was definitely a contributor to their failure. But to to pin this all on a basically minor adjustment to housing policy sounds like it came from right-wing talk radio.
But actually, you're a little tougher than that yourself in your book. I mean, you quote Barney Frank saying, "I do not want Fannie and Freddie to be just another bank." You quote him saying, "I do not want the same kind of focus on safety and soundness." Oh, I don't
That's
know the
right.
context,
That's,
but that sounds like...
No, the context is Fannie and Freddie, and the Barney Frank wanted Fannie and Freddie to support affordable housing and low-income housing. And he explicitly, he said what you quoted, and it went further because Secretary Snow, who was Secretary of the Treasury before Hank Paulson, says, well, if we let them continue to inflate their balance sheets, we're going to have to bail them out. This was in 2005. And Barney Frank said, well, we just don't do it. Of course, we just won't do it. Well, it's very easy to say that, but when Fannie and Freddie are going down, you have to do it. That wasn't the Community Investment Act. That was Congress's and in large part Barney Frank's, also Chris Dodd's, desire to use Fannie and Freddie to pump up affordable housing and to rely on that implicit government credit. And, I mean, I am tough on them and for a reason.
But you say in 2004, private label firms for the first time claimed a greater share of the market than Fannie and Freddie combined. So I guess that's kind of the handoff there.
Well, what happens then is Fannie and Freddie, they're serving two masters. And this is really what got them into trouble. They're trying to serve Barney Frank and the Congress and do good things for affordable housing. But they also have private shareholders. And they're seeing their market share slip away to private label firms like Lehman. So Fannie and Freddie go back and say, what's going on here? Well, Lehman's bundling up all these subprime mortgages. If we want to stay in the game to compete with them, we're going to have to bundle up subprime mortgages too. Now, at least with Lehman Brothers, you had some check on how much they could borrow because they were a private company. But with Fannie and Freddie, there was no check. So you had Fannie and Freddie going out and bundling up the same low-quality mortgages that Lehman and Bear Stearns and all the others were doing with absolutely no market check because they had this unending lifeline from the government. And that was just a formula, a recipe for disaster, and that's what we got.
So I hate to overbeat this drum. I hope it's not that. But this it just comes back again and again. And if we're trying to get to core causes so we can figure out core solutions, the amount of responsibility you put on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in this whole meltdown, primary, secondary, half?
It's one of the main contributors, right up there with Alan Greenspan and Chuck Prince and Bob Rubin at Citi and the credit rating agencies. I mean, they're chapter one in the book, right? And I start the book, with this guy who has the dream, Bob Rodriguez. And what's in the dream? He's in a courthouse because Fannie and Freddie have gone bankrupt 2 years early. And that's, I started the book for a reason.
Because, is that piece fixed?
Fannie, no. Freddie? Fannie and Freddie, believe it or not, are more central to the mortgage market now than they were when they failed. They are buying up 9 out of every 10 mortgages. They're totally wards of the state, and the government has this big problem of, how do we get out of this? How do we get back to, basically a system where private bankers are weighing the risks of mortgages and not fobbing it all off on Fannie and Freddie?
Speaking of fobbing off, what about credit default swaps? Remind us what those were, the central role they played, and what's going on in terms of trying to get a handle on that now.
Credit default swaps are a form of derivative, okay? And in the good old days, if you wanted to take on an obligation, it had to be on the balance sheet. It was debt. Now we have these private contracts between bankers where they make agreements, and the effect is the same, that companies will have future commitments, future obligations. So it works like debt, but it doesn't appear any place in the balance sheet. And so the disclosure is much worse. Nobody knows anything about it. The type of derivative that you're talking about, a credit default swap, works sort of like an insurance contract.
Mm-hmm.
If you, let's say you own the bond of Lehman Brothers and you're worried that Lehman Brothers may not make it, you can purchase a credit default swap which will reward you if Lehman should go under, if that bond tanks. Now, The only thing is, in a normal insurance contract, you can't take out insurance on me, Tom, with all due respect, because, you know, even though I like you, I wouldn't want you to have an incentive in anything happening
to
me.
For you to go down.
Mm-hmm. And nor with the government or with insurance regulators. Mm-hmm. But in the credit default swaps, there are no such regulations. In fact, they really function like a Wild West casino. If you imagine that, you know, Harrah's or Trump Casino announced they were opening up a new table where you could place bets on which companies are going to live and which companies are going to die, that's exactly how they operate. And what happened? When people began to place bets that Lehman, even Morgan Stanley, even Goldman were going down, their bankers got worried. They said, hey, Las Vegas is betting against you. We're not going to give you credit. And it just, you know, snowballed. It became a vicious circle where these banks were really pushed over the edge because of it. I think we need a lot more regulation of derivatives than we have.
Which, you said they should be banned. Is that in the works or anything like that?
Nothing in the works. You know, that's me. I mean, no one's close to that. I don't think Harrah's Casino should trade credit default swaps, and I don't think Wall Street should. I think the world got along, you know, very well without them. If you think of the pharmaceutical industry, every time a new drug is invented, it doesn't go on the market. People test it first, and they think about, hey, is this innovation, you know, on balance going to help more people or hurt more people? So for some reason in finance, we think, you know, every sort of mad invention of financial innovators is automatically good.
But wait, is this getting cleaned up or not, Roger? Do the House and Senate bills address it, the credit default swap problem, or not?
What they're talking about is putting some derivatives on an exchange. Commonplace copper futures, wheat futures, those trade on an exchange. Mm-hmm. And those have the great benefit that the exchanges can set the margin requirements that function like capital requirements. And they can enforce disclosure so everybody knows you're into copper, he's into wheat. This is how much the total exposure is. Right now,
the transparency is there.
So there's more transparency. Mm-hmm. Right now, this is mostly done undercover. Unfortunately, the bills leave loopholes so that it's really hard to tell, derivatives will still be able to be traded off exchange. At a very minimum, I would say, if you want to, you know, this is good for copper futures traders, it ought to be good for you. I don't see the copper market bringing down Wall Street. There's no excuse for leaving these out in the Wild West era of trading undercover. They should all be on exchanges.
Let's get to our callers. Pompano Beach, Florida. Jay, you're on the air with Roger Lowenstein.
Yes, Tom, this question is for Roger. And I've been trying to figure out, how did Goldman Sachs last quarter of 2009 have their biggest profit in the history of their existence, whereas 1 year before that they were on their they had to be bailed out by all of us. How did they do it? What were they selling? Because the mortgages are dead, automobile industry is stalled. Are they selling tacos or alligators? What are they doing? What's their security that they're selling now?
Roger?
Well, it's sort of guessing your craw, doesn't it? Two things happened. One is the bond market did have a huge rally. The prices of junk bonds and many other bonds, even mortgage bonds, off the low levels they were. You know, they were trading at, just real depressed levels, and they came roaring back. And the other thing is the Federal Reserve has been kind enough if you're a bank like Goldman is, to keep rates at, basically 0% mm-hmm. right now. So if you're a bank, you can borrow for next to nothing. And, any kind of a loan you make, you're going to have just a huge spread. And that spread is just, that's like a meal ticket for banks. And kind of gets in my craw, too.
Let's go to Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi. A few quick questions. Why should my 3-year-old kid be on the hook for paying back the over $1 trillion that the Fed just purchased in mortgage-backed securities? Why should my kid be on the hook for paying back the AIG bailout, which was really a bailout of Goldman because they were AIG's counterparty, which is still going on? Why can't we borrow at 0% at the Fed's discount window, like you mentioned the banks can, and cut out the middleman? Tom used the word corruption at the banking level, but these things are run by the government. It seems like that word ought to be applied to the government policies as well.
Steve, let us dive in on those. Roger, you know, we heard recently that there was actually a tidy profit for the government on some of the TARP money that went out the door. So is Steve's three-year-old going to be paying for the things he's describing and more, and what about that balance?
Well, the government will make a profit on the TARP investment in most of the banks, maybe even all of them, because their stocks have rebounded. I doubt very seriously the government's going to make a profit on AIG. I doubt it's going to make a profit on Bear Stearns. It certainly won't make a profit on Fannie and Freddie or General Motors. And so, yes, I think Steve's three-year-old is going to be paying for a lot of that coming down the pike.
How do we escape? I mean, his three-year-old maybe can't escape paying for that, maybe for corruption. How do we escape the corruption that comes with bankers knowing that they are likely to be bailed out when it hits the fan?
Let me just address the other part of that question, because mm-hmm. we've had this, I think, mentality in government that, you know, we shouldn't have to pay for this. But all of our three-year-olds, I mean, the government protects in the military. The government builds highways for all of us. We've had this mentality that we should have health care, pensions, bailouts, but we shouldn't somehow pay for them. That was really the original sin of Fannie and Freddie. Lyndon Johnson wanted to take Fannie off the books so their obligations wouldn't show up on the books, but continue to get the benefits by virtue of what Fannie and Freddie were doing for affordable housing. I think, you know, as a country, we have to get away from the idea that we want all these things, but we shouldn't pay for them, because a lot of the problems of the banks, you know, they're now showing up on the federal government's books. Mm. And I know there's no sympathy out there for raising taxes, but the idea that we can just delay it and we shouldn't pay for it doesn't work.
Okay, I take your point, but still, you know, part of this is the casino you described, and the three-year-old is paying for that too, for super CEO pay and the whole kind of Wild West that took hold.
So obviously what we should realize now is that since we can't escape, we the public, we the government, can't escape the bailout costs when these things crack up, we have to prevent another one. And, you know, the best way to do that, you can look at this crash, you can look at the one 10 years earlier, you can look at the one in the 80s. We know. Just don't let these banks get so leveraged, because when you're leveraged, you don't have any margin for error.
But the reality check, Roger, is you already said earlier that they're not taking the steps to truly rein in that leverage. So I mean, on the one hand, you know, we can't let it happen again. On the other hand, we have to bail out when it happens, but we're not taking the steps to prevent it necessarily. It would just seem set up again.
Well, you know, I sure hope they do. I wonder if your listeners appreciate what 30-to-1 leverage means. That means if your assets go down by even 3%, you're bankrupt, okay? To allow banks to take that kind of risk, to me, seems criminal.
Martin in Charlottesville, Virginia. What do you think, Martin?
I'm a conservative, Tom.
Yes, sir.
How are you today?
Okay, very well, thank you.
And I'm African-American, and I had the chance to take one of those loans, and I didn't. So I think there's definitely some problems with the people who don't want to take responsibility on their own. However, I'm kind of upset that conservatives and liberals, or conservatives and progressives, are so busy name calling that we're not fixing this problem. And how do we fix this problem?
Roger, that's a tough.
Well, I would like to stop banks from taking on so much debt. I think we should disallow derivatives trading undercover and force it on all into an exchange. As Tom pointed out, I'd like to get rid of the credit default swap market.
But how do you make the consensus to make these things happening? I think our caller is pointing to, because it's not there yet necessarily.
You know, we need legislators with some guts. You know, obviously, I think in the, you know, he mentioned being offered one of these loans and not mm-hmm. taking it. Mm-hmm. A very simple prescription for the mortgage business is everybody got a mortgage this time around on the basis that when the thing rolled over to a new rate, they'd refinance it. You shouldn't be able to give a mortgage to somebody just because they can refinance it. You've got to be able to state that that person will be able to pay off the loan as is. Otherwise, you're looking for you're counting on the greater fool theory. He can't pay me back, but someone else will lend him money, and then it'll be their problem.
So those who don't step up to help get regulation in place here, Republican or Democrat,
they are sowing the seeds for Steve's three-year-old's future tax bill.
And the new intellectual model to replace the one you say the crash put paid to, the one that built the bubble? Is there one yet? Is there a new, you know, do we have a sort of social understanding of a new way of thinking about the Wall Street's role?
You know, I think the model that we had, it'll be closer, I hope, to what we had before the 80s, this free market era that we're a capitalist country, we're a free market country, but we have the government in there setting speed limits, putting controls and not giving banks and other financial players absolute license to do whatever they want.
Well, there's a lot on the line, and the solution's far from fixed yet. Roger Lowenstein, I hope you'll come back and talk with us about what we get served as a response here, ultimately. I really thank you for being with us today, Roger. Thank you so much.
Tom, it's always good to be on the show.
Roger Lowenstein, author of The End of Wall Street. Listeners, thank you very much for your calls and thoughts today. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.